Hello and welcome to another episode of the CSW Free to Believe Spotlight Series podcast on North Korea. I'm Sam Jackson Reed, and it's just me this week. Kiri and Darren are away, but we're not slowing down. We are back into our series on North Korea after a few weeks looking at Sudan and looking at Nigeria as those issues came to the forefront of some of the media that we've been seeing across the world. Before we jump into our episode with Jonathan Corrado, the Director of Policy at the Korea Society in New York, which is a fascinating conversation all about how we engage diplomatically, broadly diplomatically with North Korea, and we have so few options. Before we jump into that, just two things, two pieces of housekeeping. One is a slight correction that I need to make after the episode on Sudan with Mohamed El-Noor last week. In that episode, we mentioned a moment that happened on social media where the accounts of the famous footballer Dembele and the manager Jurgen Klopp, we said that they had tweeted and posted, you know, "Free Sudan." We then found out literally hours after the episode went up that actually those were fan accounts. They weren't official accounts. So I just want to make sure that is clear. They did still reach multiple hundreds of thousands of people. So our point about spreading awareness still stands, but we just want to make sure it's really clear that we found out that they were fan accounts, they weren't official accounts. So that's just up top to make sure that's clear. And then the second thing is we would love your feedback. This podcast exists as a resource. Our hope is it would be educational and it would inform people on the global landscape of religious freedom, on the issues that are facing the countries and cases that we as CSW work on, and would give you information that you can act upon. That's our hope with this. So we want this to be a dialogue with those listening. Please do give us your feedback. The best way to do that is to drop us a message on Facebook or on Instagram. Facebook, we're just CSW. You search for CSW, you see our logo in pink. On Instagram, CSW_UK. Or drop us an email, admin@csw.org.uk. Just make sure with the email to title your email with something like podcast feedback, and we'll get it. We want to improve this. We want this to work. We want this to be something that you feel informed by and is resourcing you as you continue to learn, and I continue to learn, and we all continue to learn and work towards a world where everyone is free to believe. Without further ado, though, I'm going to hand over to David Simpson, our advocate on North Korea, as he interviews Jonathan Corrado, Director of Policy for the Korea Society. It's a fantastic episode, really informative, and I hope you enjoy.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. You recently wrote an article for NK News where you share that Kim Jong-un is winning the war for young North Koreans' hearts and minds. Can you expand on that and share a little bit more about what you mean and how that is having effect on young North Koreans in North Korea today?
Certainly, yeah. Thank you so much for having me. So that article began its life as a much longer, possibly more boring article that I wrote for George Washington Institute of Korean Studies that was more academic in nature, but was using survey data to find out how recent North Korean refugees are thinking and feeling about their country, the leadership, their economy, et cetera. So really, really interesting surveys. So just to back up a little bit, I think it's important to mention that right now we're having a lot of trouble getting information out of the country. And there have been some efforts to find out what North Korean people are thinking and feeling, especially since COVID. That pandemic border closure has been really, really effective at sealing, preventing ideas from going in and coming out, and preventing goods and also people, right? So the flow of people leaving the country has slowed to a trickle. And that's important and problematic for a number of reasons, chiefly because these are people who are seeking a better life for themselves and they deserve that. But also because for the perspective of researchers, it means it's really, really difficult to see how things have changed. How bad did the economy get during COVID? how are people thinking and feeling about Kim Jong-un, about North Korea, about South Korea, right? Really interesting, since Kim Jong-un's government changed its policy and will no longer pursue unification. How do ordinary people feel about that? Because from our previous surveys that come from, so the Institute of Peace and Unification Studies from Seoul National University is the one that's been doing this very, very consistent annual survey of recent defectors. And North Korean people who are responding to that question have been very upbeat about unification. They see it as a positive thing and welcome it. So wonder if there's been any change after the government instituted that policy. So let's talk a little bit about how many people in North Korea are engaging with foreign media since COVID. So there have been a couple of efforts to try to unpack this. One was a really interesting one by Unification Media Group in 2022 that surveyed North Koreans actually inside North Korea. And they found that 18% consumed foreign radio and 98% consumed video. But we don't know exactly how often they were consuming. Interestingly there, it said that 88% of respondents of this UMG survey from 2022 saw people getting punished for consuming foreign media. And half of the survey respondents had personally given a bribe to avoid punishment. So that's pretty astonishing, right? Like, so first of all, it means that people are willing to risk this punishment, and the punishments are pretty severe. We can get to them later. They got even more severe after a recent legislative change, the anti-reactionary thought law in 2022. So they're willing to risk that in order to access this content. So, despite all this, we'll get back to my original contention, which is that young people have sort of changed their views of late. And when I say of late, I mean those who left North Korea in 2019, between 2015 and 2019, compared to those who left North Korea in 2011 to 2015. So what we found when we looked at the data and we parsed by the age groups, we found that the people who left later had more positive views of socialism, more positive views of Kim Jong-un, and more positive views of Juche ideology compared to their peers from 2014. And my contention is that the Kim Jong-un regime's crackdown on the availability of foreign media had a pretty dramatic effect on people's ability to find these disconfirming narratives, to seek them out, and to be able to consume them more ably. And then I think that informs the way that they look at the North Korean government, and the falling availability of outside media has resulted in more positive feelings, you know, because if you don't have South Korean K-pop and foreign radio and all of these other things to be able to consume and sort of check the narrative that you're getting from the Kim Jong-un regime, you're relying more on what you're hearing from your organizational life, your school, from North Korean media. And by the way, over this time, North Korean media has gotten better. And Kim has really pushed towards the cultivation of the ideological leanings of young people because he knows the future. He's thinking in terms of generations, right? Like, he's not like an American president or a South Korean president that's thinking 4 years from now, 8 years from now, 5 years from now. He's thinking in terms of generations. And so this young population is critical for him. And he's making inroads there, according to the data that I've seen.
That's fascinating, Jonathan. And it may surprise some folks to hear that we have the understanding of North Korea as a hermetic kingdom. It's known as the Hermit Kingdom. Yet a high 90% of people there have watched outside media, outside news. And they're even bribing officials to do that. But in more recent years, that's become increasingly hard. Can you share a little bit about how crucial is the role of outside media and access for outside media for the progress of human rights? And what strategies have proven most effective in breaking through Pyongyang's information blockade, particularly, as you say, after the more severe punishments added to the 2022 anti-reactionary and thought law?
Absolutely. Yeah. So first of all, the right to receive and impart information and ideas is a human right as outlined by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So the UN sees fit to regard this as quite an important right that all individuals are entitled to. So what does it do when North Koreans have access to foreign media? Well, first, it allows them to challenge some regime narratives. So I'll just go through a few of these. So the regime gets away with saying some pretty wild, factually inaccurate things because people don't have the ability to access other sources of credible information easily. That could disconfirm that. So one thing that the North Korean regime claims and has claimed for seven decades is that South Korea and the United States started the Korean War, right? We know that's not true. The Soviet archives were opened up when the Cold War ended and Russia showed us all of these documents that very clearly reveal that this was a design of Kim Il-sung's with the support of Stalin and then later with Mao. So, it's just something that North Korean people wouldn't know, right? Because they're being told something else. We also know that when North Koreans view and consume foreign media, they have increased feelings of fondness and curiosity towards South Korea. And that's really good, right? When you think about trying to imagine a Korean peninsula that has a smaller likelihood of devolving into violence and warfare and a higher likelihood of achieving some kind of rapprochement, whatever that looks like. Having people on both halves of the peninsula who like each other is a good thing. Another thing that they can learn from these from foreign sources of information are things like the truth of Kim Il-sung's past, right? So during trusteeship, he was willing to postpone unification and he tolerated trusteeship instead of pushing for independence. And that distinguished him from his competitors, Park Hon-young and Cho Man-sik, who were like, no, independence now, unification now, right? And so Kim Il-sung had tried to hide this inconvenient fact in order to burnish his credentials as the most legitimate representation of the North Korean people, but indeed the entire Korean peninsula. They also hide the fact that Kim Jong-un's mom, Ko Young-hee, was born in Japan and was a mistress to Kim Jong-un's father. And so therefore she would have low songbun because of this, right? But of course, the fact that someone's mother was born in Japan doesn't mean that they should have a low status, right? The problem isn't that she was born in Japan. The problem was the songbun system in the first place, right? So they're hiding facts that are inconvenient for the ruling class in order to reinforce this oppressive system. They could also learn relative living standards, learn the truth about their own situation and their place in the world, learn that the phrase nothing to envy is actually quite farcical. And so one thing that we see is North Koreans, when they consume Korean dramas, they are shocked to see the modern cosmopolitan Seoul and people navigating their lives with relative freedom and ease, having the right to choose things. And last, they can learn what human rights mean, right? Because North Koreans don't really have a concept of what ingwan, human rights, like what does that actually mean? What kind of protections do they deserve and what should they expect? And so over time, this accumulated knowledge spreading through the population could have the effect of very incremental change. Multi-levels of pressure applied to try to get people to act more normal, preparing for a soft landing, right? A change where you don't see a radical, sudden shift. I think that would be really disastrous for the Korean Peninsula, but a slow incremental change, this helps it. In terms of strategies, and there's like three important concepts to keep in mind. One is cat and mouse, right? This is a game of innovation where the pursuers are constantly trying to come up with better technologies, better techniques in order to stop the importation and distribution of foreign media. The next is flood the zone, right? I mean, no one technique is going to work in isolation. You need lots of different things: USBs, micro SDs, mesh networks, radio, and different. We find that different demographics like different forms of media. Like, we see that the older generation is more fond of radio, for instance, and that people who consume radio are more interested in content such as political content, whereas those who consume video and music are more interested in entertainment. And when you ask North Koreans, what are you interested in? They say entertainment news from South Korea. And when you ask North Koreans, what do you think North Korean people need to consume? They say news information from South Korea. And then the last concept, so it's flood the zone, cat and mouse, and the last one is collateral damage. And it's important to minimize and reduce however much possible collateral damage. Now, this is fundamentally risky, right? Because North Koreans who are caught with these materials are subject to punishment. So I think it's incumbent on those who are planning to distribute foreign content to think through what are the second and third order consequences and how they could be minimized. But bearing in mind, you know, the bottom line, which is that North Koreans deserve free information and they deserve the right to be able to make that choice for themselves. And of course, what the survey shows us is that most people decide that they do want that information.
Interesting you shared that what North Koreans want is entertainment news. They want the latest gossip on what K-pop stars are dating who and all that kind of stuff. But what we in the West and we in the human rights community think they need is news and facts. And I think that plays into the cognitive biases we've developed around thinking about North Korea. The 2014 Commission of Inquiry said it was a place without parallel in the world. And I think we think about it uniquely. And I think that develops certain cognitive biases. And you've written and you've done some work around this, particularly around cognitive biases in assessments of security, North Korea as a security risk. Can you maybe share a little bit about how do you think these biases more broadly shape and affect our understandings of human rights advocacy and humanitarian policy towards North Korea? And that understanding of we think they want one thing, but actually the situation on the ground is they want something else entirely.
Yeah, that's a great question. I had to do some thinking to come up with a suitably okay answer in order to match the moment. I think there's a lot. The first one I'll mention is confirmation bias, which is the tendency to search for and focus on information that confirms one's preconceptions. And we all know that the field of North Korean studies is extremely tribal, right? You've got engagement-oriented folks over here, deterrence-oriented folks over here, human rights people, humanitarian people, and they all are looking at North Korea in a way that will justify what they've already decided is the right solution, rather than looking at the evidence in and of itself and then making policy decisions on the basis of what's actually going on. Another one that I've seen a lot is fundamental attribution error. So that's the tendency that people have to overemphasize personality-based explanations for behaviors that others are doing and underemphasizing the role of the context situation itself. So when someone does something, people are likely to say, oh, that's who they are. That's why they did that thing. And very interestingly, people don't apply this error when they're looking at their own behaviors. In fact, they tend to say, oh, it was the context. Oh, it was the situation, and downplay the role of personality-based explanations. So in terms of North Korea, I remember talking to an aid worker who said, who'd been to North Korea dozens of times. And she said to me, you know, after 5 trips, I knew everything. After 50 trips, I realized I knew nothing. Right. So it's just about having this humility when we're acting with North Koreans and understanding that most of the North Koreans that we interact with are under tremendous pressure, under the microscope, under strain, and we should just have a little grace in trying to understand what are the things motivating the way that they think and say. The next two are more relevant to diplomatic strategy, but they're really interesting, so I thought I'd mention them. One is called hyperbolic discounting. So that's when you tend to prefer immediate payoffs relative to later payoffs. So it just feels sweeter to have something now rather than later. And then the other one is zero risk bias. And that's the preference for reducing a small risk to zero over a bigger reduction in a larger risk. And I think both of these really do a lot to explain the way in which we tend to approach North Korea diplomatically. And especially when you consider that U.S. administrations have 4 years, Korean administrations have 5 years, you have a finite time frame in which to get things done. So these biases really come into play. And then the last one I'll mention is illusion of transparency. And that's the tendency to overestimate the degree to which your own mental state is known by others. And I think that we see this all the time in terms of, you know, intentions gone wrong or misinterpreted when we're pursuing either humanitarian or human rights policies with North Korea. And by the way, to end all this, we're not the only ones who have biases, right? Our friends have biases, those in North Korea, the regime has its own biases, right? So it's a multi-level game where there's all types of opportunity for confusion. And so it's worth it to, I think the bottom line takeaway here is humility is very valuable given all this, and just sensitivity to what the actual evidence says.
I think it makes sense that there is such an aversion to risk, and particularly the diplomatic negotiations. Other countries in the world that if it goes really bad in a negotiation, there might be a tariff, there might be an ambassador summoned, and there might be an invite to dinner taken away. And the stakes are lower. But when we think about North Korea, that you think nuclear Armageddon, like that's as bad as it could get. Right. And so I think it makes total sense that there's such an aversion to risk in many of these conversations. And I think connecting it to policy and human rights, most people have heard about North Korea in the context of nuclear proliferation. What do you think the balance is in between maintaining that on the agenda, but also bringing human rights into it? How can advocates, how can diplomats ensure that human rights remain in these diplomatic engagements with Pyongyang, and we don't only get sucked into conversations around nuclear proliferation, particularly in an era where the current U.S. president said they're resuming nuclear testing just this week?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting area, and there's been some interesting research and thinking about this, and I'll just pluck what I've seen. And so one trend lately is called securitization of human rights, and that's just linking North Korea's systemic human rights abuses with its nuclear weapons program. And there's a lot of ways in which that happens. One way is the manner in which prison labor is utilized from some of the weapons programs, the ways that the workers are treated. We did a really interesting program called the Bluebird Post. North Korea Reform Radio has a terrific program where they broadcast into North Korea these stories of refugees living in the South, writing letters. So it's Bluebird Post. And they speak them over the radio to their relatives who are back home, back home in North Korea. So as you can imagine, these are really sad, and they're talking to people who, you know, maybe will hear this, probably won't, but it's nonetheless really, really powerful for folks back in North Korea to know that, hey, the people who have left, we really miss you, and we did it not for the reasons that the regime says. One of these speakers who came and told us all about Their story was the relative of a worker in a nuclear power plant. And they ended up dying from exposure to radiochemical poisoning. And so just making that link between human rights, the way that the regime treats its people and those who are, you know, working on behalf of the nuclear weapons program, and the fact that these human rights abuses are occurring is one way. The other argument that I've seen is that North Korea can demonstrate good faith and build trust if it does start to make some meaningful improvements in its human rights situation. And this wouldn't be without precedent, right? Like, we have seen some small little changes. Ambassador Julie Turner, the former envoy for North Korean human rights at the U.S. State Department, liked to tell the story about how pressure to stop forcibly aborting women who had been repatriated after being married to a Chinese man and then getting pregnant with a Chinese man and then getting caught and sent back to North Korea. And what they would typically do is force them to have abortions, really gruesome. And the U.S. government applied a lot of pressure, as did others. And there were a couple anecdotes, right? A couple stories of times when this didn't happen. And maybe it was because of the pressure from the outside, maybe not. But if just a few people's lives are saved, then isn't that worth it? But if North Korea can show that it's serious and making some changes, another place where we have seen some actual change, there's still more to go, is on disability rights. And there's been an engagement-oriented approach from the international community to get North Korea to more seriously address the needs of disabled people within its own population. And by engaging in good faith with the international community and making meaningful changes, we see that they're serious, that the regime itself is serious. And it's worth mentioning that the first principle of the Singapore summit, which is really worth building on, commits the U.S. and North Korea to establish new relations, right? So what does new relations look like? Well, the North Korea that improves its human rights is probably going to be a North Korea that's more willing to engage in some of those other principles of the Singapore summit. So those are just some ways that these two concepts can be linked, although they sometimes seem like they're at odds. I'm not so sure that that's the case.
We know that the more money that the regime in Pyongyang pumps into bombs and nuclear armament is money that's not spent on food, this money that's not spent on schools, this money that's not spent on houses. So there's an enormous drain on the finite resources in the country. And kind of connecting to some of your earlier discussions around younger North Koreans, do you have any sense if younger North Koreans are challenging regime narratives? You've spoken about the extreme risks some younger North Koreans are taking in order to watch K-dramas and engage in other medias. Or do you think the new pressure added to the anti-reactionary thought law, do you think that is kind of crushing their will and subduing their aspirations to challenge the regime?
Yeah, so this is a great question. I think we in the outside world are presented with two starkly different versions of what North Korea's youth is like. So when we watch North Korean state media, we see the teenagers and 20-somethings, they are loyal proponents of Kim Jong-un's revolutionary cause. And then when we look at other sources, we hear the phrase Jangmadang Shidae, like the market generation. These are folks that are very, very influenced by the foreign media that they've consumed, and they are deeply skeptical about the regime and socialism and all that stuff. And this is important, right? Because the ideological orientation of the youth really speaks to the viability of the regime in a long-term sense. So then we got this anti-reactionary thought law, first enacted 2020, then amended in 2022. And it describes all South Korean movies, dramas, news, et cetera, as reactionary thought and culture. And the punishments for consuming and distributing this content went way up. So you get 6 years to life for consuming and 10 years or even execution for being an actual distributor. The law also included some specific things that are banned. And what do we learn from this? Well, if North Korea is taking the time to make a law that bans certain things, we know that they're happening. People are using them, and it is frustrating to the regime. So I'll give you a couple examples. One is the phrase oppa, older brother, but also used for South Koreans use it to refer to, you know, older men in their orbit, whether it's their boyfriend or whatever. And it's really, really popular. You hear it all over South Korean media content. And another one is nim, adding nim, sajang nim. Those are both banned. Another thing that was banned was aegyo, so cutesy speech. And so I thought this was kind of funny. The law says citizens shall not imitate puppet style South Korean intonation by raising and lengthening their intonation at the end of a phrase in an obsequious, lilting, and nauseating way, end quote. So that's aegyo, right? This cutesy form of speaking. And so that's also been banned, right? So using these phrases, using the speech pattern, is a way of signifying to others in your orbit that you're a consumer of this stuff and it is affecting you safely, right? Because you can't just go out and say, hey, did you see the latest episode of blah, blah, blah? Did you hear the latest K-pop song? You can't openly say that because you could open yourself up to punishment. But through these little subtle ways, you can sort of communicate that you are doing it. Okay, so why do I think that the younger generation is doing this a little bit, is maybe having less access to foreign information and is becoming more positive towards the regime? So as I said earlier, I looked into this data from Seoul National University refugee surveys, and I found some really interesting things. So first, people, the younger generation, were more likely to believe than the older generation that Kim Jong-un had majority support in the country compared to older folks. 20-year-olds and 30-somethings were less likely to hear criticism about the government and about Kim Jong-un compared to people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, where that was much more common for them to hear criticism. And in 2014, so this earlier cohort, young people at that time had less pride in Juche, the state ideology, than the older generation. But then in 2020, that dynamic flipped entirely. So over half of the young respondents had a lot or some pride in Juche, while the majority of older respondents had not much or none. Right. So in that short time, we saw a pretty dramatic change in the way that the younger generation and the older generation are thinking and feeling about the North Korean government. And one of my contentious, so there's a lot of different reasons why this might be the case, right? Maybe North Korean propaganda is becoming more effective. But if that's the case, why are only young people changing their views while older people are becoming more critical? It could be the case that the crackdown on foreign media has been effective and that's changing the way that people perceive their situation. I think that's true. It could be the case that having some experience, exposure, and interaction with the marketplace is a really important predictor of what your views of the North Korean regime are going to be. Because when you're in the marketplace, the regime becomes an impediment to your livelihood. And so North Korean men are 10 years of government service, military service, and then they're assigned to a factory job or a farm job in which they make enough in wages to pay for maybe a few kilograms of rice per month, right? So basically nothing. You're basically working and making nothing. Whereas the women, the mothers, have the responsibility of going out into the marketplace and earning the livelihood for their families. And the vast majority of families get the vast majority of their income through the markets, right? And so perhaps it's the case that exposure to these markets is the key predictor of what your views are going to be. But that still doesn't explain, I think that's also a powerful dynamic, and that's true. But it also doesn't explain why the young people flipped, right? It could explain why the older generations became more critical. Maybe market crackdowns had intensified over that period and then they became even more upset. But it doesn't explain why the young people who aren't working in these markets, right? Young people are at school all day. They've got their organizational life. Maybe they're helping out their parents here and there, but by and large, they are busy doing their own stuff. And then they've got military service. Even the women, the young women in North Korea have military service. So that doesn't really explain it. And so my conclusion is that it is the media landscape that is ultimately the most important factor in driving these changes in which we see the younger generation becoming more positive towards the Kim regime. And again, just a reminder, this data is from before COVID, and we just don't know. There has been some surveys come out since then, but they're not at this granular level where we can parse by the age cohort. And so it remains a mystery until we get enough data to confirm what's going on since then, exactly what the root cause is, and if things have changed, gotten worse, gotten better since this time.
To hear the granular effect that South Korean culture is having on North Korea, even to the extent of shaping language. And we know it takes a long time for language to be shaped. And so it is fascinating to see that there's that level of influence on the culture. And I wonder, too, in terms of the slightly more positive outlook on the regime by younger North Koreans, I wonder what effect the Great Famine of the early 90s plays into this, that sort of Gen Z North Koreans don't have that memory of a cataclysmic failure of the government that their parents or grandparents do. And they've seen, well, yeah. I went to school, I go to the army, I get a uniform, I get some meals. And like they've just not seen the government fail spectacularly in a way. They didn't have to bury brothers and sisters or children.
I think that's a great point. And one piece of evidence to support this point is that some of the most critical people were in their 40s in 2020, right? So if you're in your 40s in 2020, that means you grew up during the famine itself. You saw the government fail. That was a big part of your childhood, your family life. And then you saw the people lift themselves up by their own bootstraps and provide their own salvation, right? And the government acting against them in a lot of cases. And so this it makes sense to me, given this experience, that this particular cohort, those folks in their 40s, would be the most critical age group.
And we're just spitballing now, but it's not as if there'll be articles in textbooks about the famine. I'm sure family members, it will be hard for them to talk about it openly, not purely because of the trauma, but also because of the consequences of disparaging the regime talked about it. So no, I do think that's another factor that came to mind for me. Shifting gears a little bit, we're in a time where many of the institutions that have upheld international policy, international platforms for human rights are radically reassessing what does their future look like, how do they operate, places like the UN in particular. Where do you see the future of advocacy with places like the UN, with NGO engagement, and how do you see a continued push that the people have been pushing for decades to change the human rights situation through places like the UN, and they've not had much success? The UN themselves has said that the situation is worse today than it was 10 years ago at the time of the Commission of Inquiry. What do you think some of the biggest limitations are? And in this shifting sand of a landscape, where do you see new areas of growth and new areas of access where people might start to engage that they haven't done previously?
Yeah, so this is a very frustrating time for people who care about North Korean human rights. And I think, fundamentally, there's been this geopolitical shift with Russia and China now being more forthright in their unwillingness to work together on new sanctions at the Security Council, but also to employ any leverage that they have to get North Korea to cooperate and collaborate. And so North Korea has been able to utilize these larger regional schisms, as it has in the past, right? This is nothing new. Kim Il-sung utilized these schisms in order to get support for his invasion of the South, and thereby making it impossible for Mao Zedong to engage in his unification war by amphibiously attacking Taiwan. And then during the Sino-Soviet split as well, Kim Il-sung was able to utilize those tensions to secure, play two sides against the middle and get a security pact from both countries, you know, a mutual defense treaty from both countries, really valuable for it. So like North Korea really punches above its weight in terms of looking at these larger geopolitics and using that to its advantage. And so it sees, you know, any kind of mention of human rights or work on human rights as an infringement on its sovereignty and just will not cooperate at all. So this puts us in a pickle, right? It's a question of leverage. It's a question of government resistance. And looking forward, there's two types of advocacy. There's collaborative and there's subversive. And it seems like they might be at a cross purpose, but that's not always the case, right? It's a bit of a sliding scale. And oftentimes human rights initiatives will have elements of both. For instance, even humanitarian assistance, right, brings North Koreans into contact with Americans and kind of dispels those mistaken notions that they get from regime propaganda about evil imperialists and their plans to menace North Korea, and those bags of rice that say, you know, a gift from America, those end up places and people see them, right?
So looking ahead, where do you see innovative approaches, whether that's technological, diplomatic, or grassroots, and where do you think they could make the most difference in improving the human rights conditions in North Korea over the next decade or even further ahead?
So I definitely think that this improvement in geopolitics is the real key to unlocking the substantial gains in human rights improvements. And we saw that the first principle in the Singapore summit that I mentioned earlier was to establish new relations, and that is ultimately going to be the driver of the best change. That type of rapprochement is going to have the spillover effects to this larger change. And there remains this like deep philosophical debate about subversive strategies and pressure strategies versus engagement strategies, what's most effective. But I think what's most important is to not throw our hands up and do nothing while we wait for the ideal conditions and the ideal strategy to just suddenly emerge in an epiphany. I have a friend named Joseph Kim. He's a refugee from North Korea who's written a really beautiful book. He was a gojebi, so like one of those homeless children during the famine. And his story is really incredible. And now he's got a master's from Harvard University. So just an incredible journey. And when I asked him about the frustration of making improvements on human rights, the way he looked about it was he talked to me about butterflies. And I was a little surprised. Butterflies. So he talked about this monarch butterfly that makes a migration. It's like hundreds of miles, and it's actually impossible to accomplish it within the lifespan of a single butterfly. So it's like multiple generations it takes to make the migration successfully. And so that's the way he's looking at human rights improvements, right? Even if it's slow, even if it's incremental, it's still worth pursuing. And when future North Koreans look back, and they'll see that the world didn't sit idly by, that people cared and people worked to try to help them. And especially when that wasn't easy to do, people still cared. I think that that's going to matter when we get to a moment of rapprochement. The Korean Peninsula can't last like this forever, right? Locked in the state of enmity, intersection of all these geopolitical rivalries. It just cannot be this way forever. So when that moment comes, when that day comes, or indeed when this incremental, very slow change initiates, it's going to be really important to look back and point to, here's what we were trying to do.
I think that's a very helpful point to end on. That, and I also think that there's a certain motivation to be the one that cracked the nut, as it were, that this particular government, this NGO, one to finally bring the Kim regime down and break open North Korea to the world. But I think there needs to be sort of a humility and an understanding that we are all small pieces in a much longer arc. And I think to have that kind of chip away approach, a collaborative chip away, as opposed to being the one to do it, I think it's a helpful reminder that we're participating with others who have gone before us, and there'll be others that will come after us. And to see it as a kind of collaborative approach to human rights in North Korea versus kind of this ego-driven approach to be the one that breaks North Korea.
Right.
Great. Well, Jonathan, you've been very generous with your time, with your wisdom, and with your expertise, and thank you for sharing that with us today.
I was delighted to speak with you. Thank you so much. You asked some great questions, and I hope it spurs even more conversation.
Thank you so much. And if you're keen to learn more about Jonathan, you can search for him as part of the Korea Society in New York. So thank you, Jonathan.
What a fantastic episode. We're so grateful to Jonathan for giving us his time. And his answers were so detailed, and I certainly learnt a lot. I think the thing that stood out most to me, particularly within the context of all that we've been speaking about over the last few weeks, is we sort of began to understand this trend that younger people, with their heightened exposure to outside foreign media, were becoming less enamored with the North Korean regime, with Juche, with the Kim family. Think back to our interview with Lee, who escaped North Korea, and he seemed to communicate to us that, you know, everyone was engaging with foreign media, and no one really believed that the Kims were that great. But the starvation, the food issues meant that people stayed in the spaces that they are. It seems that the research that Jonathan's doing and communicating is slightly different. There's something else going on. But I think what it really brought home is just how complex these situations are. And we say that a lot with many of the cases and countries that we work on. There's a complexity, but that complexity is ultimately human. It's a human complexity that we have to engage with and deal with. There's nuances, there's multi-layered issues on top of one another. And I think the thing that I'd love to draw out from Jonathan is what he said slightly towards the end there is, how do we do this with a humility that looks at what's actually going on, rather than looking for ways in which we can confirm our own biases? And connecting that with the butterfly analogy of the migration of the butterflies sometimes takes generations. And I think that's powerful and ultimately hopeful, though difficult, is actually all of us praying, campaigning, advocating for the people of North Korea. It may take a really, really long time, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. It doesn't mean we shouldn't work towards that future. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't have the faces and the names and the images of the North Korean people who are suffering in our minds and in our hearts, and have that move us to action, move us to prayer, move us to longing for and seeing change. So I think that was really powerful and profound for us to know and to hear. If you do want to find out more about what Jonathan is doing, we have put the links in the description box below to the article that he wrote and to the Korea Society as a whole if you want to go and find out more. But thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week with another episode. Goodbye. Thank you for listening to the CSW Free to Believe podcast. CSW is a Christian human rights organization advocating for freedom of religion or belief. As Christians, we stand with everyone facing injustice because of their religion or belief. This work, including the podcast, exists because of the generosity of supporters just like you. If you'd like to find out more or to make a donation, go to csw.org.uk. You can also help by sharing our work with people you know, reviewing the podcast, and following us on social media. All the links you need are in the description box underneath this episode.